News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Yes, I really am your host, Julio Diaz. I know I sound a little different today, a little bit under the weather, but I'm not going to apologize for my voice because I actually kind of like my voice when I'm a little under the weather. I like it a little better than my regular voice. So instead, I'm going to say enjoy the sick voice. I'm not enjoying the not feeling great, but I am enjoying the voice effect. So I hope you are too. And I hope that to make your day even a little bit better today, whether you're listening to 92.3 and AM 1620, or you're listening to the podcast version of the show, which of course you can do anytime, any place, anywhere. Going to hope to make your day just a little bit better by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. And joining me to do so, as he does every week, my co-host on this show, please welcome Jeremy Branch.
Man, into these sultry, dulcet tones, I feel like we're incentivized to keep you sick.
So, maybe I should break into some
Munchausen by proxy from now on.
Some Barry White or some Lou Rawls. Yeah, you'll never find down. Yeah, that's especially gonna get me out of that. I can't lie. I kind of dig it. I wish I could sound this way all the time without feeling like stuffy head, cough, sneeze. That's kind of thing I've had going on. I don't know if it's an allergy thing or what, we'll soldier through. We'll be all right.
I know that today's a show I'm particularly excited about. Every once in a while, we're able to find that perfect intersection of pop culture and little independent horror films and stuff like that. We'll probably open up to a broader conversation, but this one in particular, I'm excited about.
Yeah, so we're going to get into a little later in the show. There's a lot of phenomenon going on around YouTube right now, and which understandably so. I think it's very easy for people to forget this, but YouTube is the highest volume streaming service in the world. Like, people think, Netflix is dwarfed compared to YouTube, and you might not necessarily think about it that way because it is so set up in a way that anybody can platform themselves on YouTube. Anybody can go out with a camera or a phone out of their pocket, make stupid video, throw it up on YouTube, and it's there and there's the content. And that's for 99.9% of what gets on YouTube. That's all it is. It's there to share with the family, or five people might see it, or they might come across it by random or whatever, but it doesn't have a massive audience. But there's lots of stuff on YouTube that does find a massive audience, whether it be content that's uploaded by the Hollywood studios or TV shows or, you name it, or it be these people that just have built themselves a following and then have gone on to do other things.
But before we get into that, let's just look at somebody like Stephen Colbert, right? Where he's got a show on network television. It streams. People watch it. I'm not exactly sure of what the figures are. You might be more equipped to talk about this.
But I mean, millions.
A lot of these late shows now are getting more views when they're hooked up and shared to social media, in particular YouTube, than they are when they're actually being broadcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I just read a profile on Jimmy Kimmel in the last couple of days where he was talking about that the late night shows actually have a larger audience than they've ever had when you account for all the people watching them on social media. So,
yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. We don't live in a monoculture anymore. We've talked about this, so not everybody is in front of their TV at 11:30 Eastern watching Johnny Carson.
Right. But if there's a good SNL skit, somebody might put it on while they're sitting on the toilet or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tend to watch.
Find the YouTube version of it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really watch those shows live anymore, but I do generally watch, especially Seth Meyers and clips.
Is it that you like to kind of open up and watch the monologues in particular, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I probably watch more of the monologues and the comedy bits than I do of the interviews. Occasionally, I'll watch an interview here or there. But, with Seth Meyers, it tends to be the closer look segment, or it tends to be the monologue. Or sometimes they put them up together. some of the other like fun segments that he does from time to time, that he does like surprise inspection or Amber Says What or jokes Seth can't tell.
Those are fun.
Yeah. So, and I mean,
all of this kind of speaks to the evolution of the industry in that way, where Jimmy Kimmel does this editorial where he's talking about how late night is more popular than ever, which flies in the face of what our traditional like Nielsen ratings would say. But that kind of growth also does transfer over to film, you know, other sorts of ways that the traditional media has viewed things.
Well, and it's not
that lens does need to be kind of changed a little bit.
It's not the only monetization channel that these networks have. You know, it used to be that the only monetization of a nighttime show, of a late night show, was selling advertising during the late night show.
Good point. Yep.
Well, now you've got that. You've got then that show goes to streaming and some people watch it on you know, like the whatever the in-house streaming network is. You know, for ABC, it's Disney Plus. For CBS, it's Paramount Plus. For NBC, it's Peacock. You know, they all have an arm where their late night show goes, you know, I think sometimes in some cases goes up before it actually airs, quote unquote, live, much like this show. You can get the podcast version of the show earlier than you can actually hear it, quote unquote, live on the radio.
Like a pro.
Yeah.
Look at you.
So there's that channel for monetization, and there's the channel of putting clips up on YouTube, which they then get ad revenue from.
And then you strike everybody that does a reaction video to it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you might
get that revenue too.
You might, but I mean, you know, all of these shows have YouTube outlets, and they're making money off the advertising on YouTube.
Yep.
And I mean, if you watch YouTube, and if you don't have the YouTube Plus or whatever it's called, YouTube Deluxe, YouTube 2 Electric Boogaloo. I don't know what it's called, but you can pay for YouTube and eliminate the ads. I would say 95% of the people that watch YouTube don't do that. So if you're watching...
Well, and this is kind of a side tangent, but also related. Cobra Kai found its early success on YouTube before being shipped over to Netflix.
Yeah, YouTube had an effort, you know, for a while there to create programming, and then they decided they didn't need to do that. And you know what? They were right. They don't.
Yeah, they didn't.
No. Yeah, it was money ill spent, although, you know, Cobra Kai was the success that came out of it. Nothing else that they did out of that really flew because they're better off just being a platform. But yeah, so, yeah. You know, that it goes back to we can get back into is CBS lying about the fact that Colbert's show was bleeding money? Of course they are. But, you know, that's not really the relevant point. The relevant point is I think that's, you know, everybody is saying, what's Colbert's next move going to be? And I think that he's already kind of tipped his hand that it's going to be YouTube. He started a YouTube channel literally
Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can look at it.
He was able to find massive success.
Yeah. So the day after Late Show went off the air, Stephen Colbert was on YouTube doing an episode of a public access show out of a small town of Michigan, somewhere relatively near Detroit. And I urge you to take the time to watch it because it's one of the funniest hours of anything you're going to watch. It's hilarious. But
I need to see it.
But yeah, you know, I think if he's smart, that's the way he goes. Just monetize himself on YouTube. I mean, I know that not everybody that's going to hear my voice right now knows the name Mr. Beast. But ask.
Oh, sure they do.
But ask your kids.
Yeah, sure.
You know, ask your kids, and Mr. Beast is the biggest star on the entire planet. This guy has made himself a multimillionaire off his YouTube projects. And, you know, to the point that, yeah, he has gone out. He's, you know, now has like a candy in the stores and has he done some feature film stuff or what, you know, what else has he done?
I know he did the Beast Games on Amazon Prime, which they just spent so much money on. Massive prize giveaways. They built a city for it. So there is a hunger to capitalize on the success that these YouTubers are finding independently and then just feed them tons and tons of money. The second season just now ran. I think they're renewed for another one, and it's been a big hit on Amazon.
Well, and we're going to talk about how like people are starting to capitalize on YouTubers when we come back. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. My co-host, Jeremy Branch, is on the line with me. If you haven't watched that video in a while, I urge you, go back and watch that music video. It is one of the most gloriously 80s things you will ever see. Obsession by Animotion. Jeremy, do you hate me for playing that song for what we're going to talk about? I mean, it's
I'm here for it. I love the song, and I think it couldn't be more appropriate.
It's a little cheesily on the nose.
Sure.
But before the break, we were talking about kind of the impact of YouTube in general terms. And I think the main reason we're talking about that, and I think we may get into some ins and outs here, but there's two movies that are dominating the box office right now. And they both are horror films or horror-related films, I guess it's fair to say, that are coming from people who cut their teeth on YouTube. One is Obsession, which has been out for 3 weeks now. Four weeks this weekend. I guess it's fair to say. And has consistently... It opened pretty strongly, but week over week, the take has increased each week.
I know many of our listeners are savvy and understand a lot about the industry, but it's pretty typical for films to have about a 60% drop off from week one to week two, give or take a little bit. You know, movies that do really well, don't get it that bad.
Yeah, I mean, 60% is a big drop.
Week on week.
60% is a big drop off. Maybe like 40% for a strong film. I mean, like. Right now, people are like bagging on Mandalorian and Grogu because it dropped 69%. So, I mean, normally, like after the first, consistently week after week, after the first week, the take starts getting smaller.
And you're losing money.
Yeah.
And this one has gone up every week.
Obsession has gone up week to week each week to the extent that this past week that just finished, it was the number two movie in the country above Mandalorian and Grogu, which is only a week old and had dropped from first to, I think, third in week two, third or fourth, maybe even, because Michael is still out there raking in boatloads of money too. And I haven't looked at the final list, but Michael may have actually ended up coming in ahead.
Another thing worth mentioning while we're talking about the kind of nuts and bolts of the industry side of thing, Obsession was made with a sub-$1 million budget. It's said to have costed about $750,000. Then when it was picked up, they put about $15, maybe $20 million into marketing the film. And the word of mouth has been so strong that people are just continuing to show up for it. And I find that to be super, super awesome. Outside of all of like the story behind it, I love a good horror movie. And this is one of the best horror films of the last few years. I mean, it is easily among the three of my top favorite horror films of 2026 so far.
Well, and I mean, not just audience reaction, it's gotten very strong critical reaction too. Like, the reviews on this movie have been excellent overall as well. So it's not just that, it's not like, I'm trying to think of a good example of a movie that...
Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah, maybe. or to put it into broader terms, to not superhero terms, something like Super Mario Galaxy movie. The movie did not get good reviews, but it got good audience reviews.
Right.
Like, the critics didn't like it, but the audiences liked it, and the audience said, well, we're going to go see it anyway. That's not the case here. Like, the critics liked this movie too. But the audience reaction is just off the charts, and this movie has continued to grow from week to week rather than shrink from week to week, which is, as you said, very, very rare. And it's this filmmaker. What's the filmmaker's name?
His name is Curry Barker. I believe he's 26 years old. And I do want to talk about the broader conversation about YouTube and how it relates to movies. But just while we're on this, Curry Baker, he's made several short films. This is his first feature-length debut. He was hired by the studio Blumhouse to adapt his short story The Chair into a feature-length film, and he said, no, I'm good, I've actually got this idea. And he ran it by them, and they said, sure, go with it. So very little studio oversight, they let him do his thing, and it is really paid off in spades. And what's interesting about this is I think the week after its release, maybe 2 weeks after its release, this movie called Backrooms hits out, comes out in the theaters and becomes another just massive sensation. And if you listen to Julio and I on Let's Go Pensacola, or you're plugged into kind of movie projections, most anticipated lists, all of that kind of stuff, I don't think either of these films would have popped up on our radar as going to be breakout hits. But maybe that just means we're getting old, and that's a whole other thing. But Backrooms has come out. It was massive. It's number one in the box office.
Something like $85 million dollars in the opening weekend.
Directed by a 20-year-old kid named Kane Parsons, who learned Blender during the pandemic and created a series of shorts based on this kind of Reddit lore. And apparently it's something that a lot of Gen Z and Gen Alpha were really highly anticipating, and going to a packed theater at 7 o'clock on a Saturday night and realizing the showing I was in and the showing over at Bayou were both completely sold out is just something I would have never anticipated.
Well, and you know, again, and the difference between this and Obsession is that this is an actual adaptation of what this guy was already doing on YouTube.
So yeah, they had enough confidence in him to bring him in and let him do it.
Yeah, so this is based on, you know, a web series that he'd done. So versus Barker's coming in and creating a new original project rather than adapting his web shorts. In this case, Kane Parsons did actually adapt his web short. And, you know, not only that, managed to attract some major talent to be in this film. I mean, you know, the stars are Chiwetel Ejiofor and, I always mispronounce her name, Renate.
In Sentimental Value. I don't know her name, though.
Gosh, I can't believe I'm going to flub this. Give me just a moment here to make sure I have it. Renate Reinsieve. Yeah. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. But yeah, you know, two Academy Award nominees in the lead in this role. And, you know, Mark Duplass is in this too, which, you know, Mark Duplass.
It was produced by Osgood Perkins and James Wan, and apparently Perkins mentored the filmmaker through a lot of it. So
yeah, and
not only did he have a great cast, but he had some really strong support behind the camera as well.
And you know, of course, Jason Blum being involved in it too. So, you know, in both the cases, both these films, I believe they have some backing behind them, and that has led to some ridiculous, oh, well, they didn't really direct it kind of stuff. You know, like, their name is on it. But
can't possibly be talented.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that goes back to Tobe Hooper and Poltergeist.
Steven Spielberg, when he directed Duel at 21, funny because later on he would be the person that was attributed to taking over Poltergeist for Tobe Hooper.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly cases where that has actually happened. I mean, pretty well documented that Rogue One, the version that we actually saw, is really Tony Gilroy's version and not Gareth Edwards.
Point to any studio movie that isn't heavily guided by people above the director, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a consideration. But I mean, I'm talking more about like, go away, kid, and then somebody else comes in and directs it. With Rogue One, like the example that I'm given there, like everybody knows Tony Gilroy directed the reshoots.
Yeah,
and everybody knows that a lot of what we actually saw in the finished project was the reshoots and not stuff that Gareth Edwards shot. Gareth Edwards still has the credit on it for, you know, DGA and all that. And I think, you know, you can kind of tell the difference there in that if you look at what is the film that Gareth Edwards did fairly recently? Another sci-fi epic.
The Creator?
Yes, The Creator. And you can look at that film and be like, okay, you know, you can see where, if you go back and look at Rogue One, you can see what was his and what were his ideas versus what was Tony Gilroy's. And they're not necessarily very similar movies. There's definitely some similar overtones. And, you know, visually, The Creator is an awesome film to look at.
Yeah.
I don't know that it holds together in the way that Rogue One holds together.
Well, fortunately, both Backrooms and Obsession, which is what we're talking about, hold together very well.
Yeah, I mean, on that regard, I'm going to have to take your word for it, because unfortunately, I haven't had time to see either one of them yet. I'm really looking forward to seeing both of them. Obsession has a little bit more of an appeal to me from what I can see from the trailers, because it seems a little more straightforward. Like, I haven't been... Backrooms has very much been pushed as kind of this liminal horror thing. And I have not yet found one of those that I feel really good about.
There's a abstractness, like an M.C. Escher painting to Backrooms. And, you know, I know you're a fan of A24's projects. So with that in mind, I think you'll appreciate it. It's not as abstract as maybe something that David Lynch would have directed. And I think you're a fan of him as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to take your word for it on Backrooms, but like I keep seeing people compare it to Skinamarink. And
I don't think that's accurate.
Okay, good, because like Skinamarink was not a film for me.
Way, way, way more experimental than Backrooms is.
Okay, that's good. I mean, you know, I like the actors involved here. I'm interested in seeing the movie. I've heard nothing but good things about it. But as soon as I hear that description of liminal horror, it's like, I don't know.
You don't think empty rooms are scary?
I mean, I guess they can be. Let's talk about it some more when we come back. You're listening. Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. My co-host, Jeremy Branch, is on the line with us. We were talking about primarily, I'd say, two new movies that just came out in the last few weeks, Obsession and Backrooms, that are both the creations of these two directors and writers who have kind of risen up from YouTube to create these two runaway successful films. And, you know, we can also lump in Markiplier, who did Iron Lung earlier this year, is also another filmmaker that sprung up from YouTube. And there's a number of these. It's kind of a phenomenon right now. But before we get into talking about like the overall phenomenon, Jeremy, you've had a chance to see both of these movies. I have not. So I'm starting with Backroom, since that's the newest one, give me kind of the TLDR without spoiling anything on Backrooms.
Absolutely. So it stars, as you mentioned, Chiwetel Ejiofor as Clark. Clark owns this furniture store, but he has aspirations of being an architect. He's having some problems at his house, and so he's kind of retreated to this furniture store. And kind of in a drunken haze, he stumbles into this alternate world known as the Backrooms. It's kind of like a mirror image of the furniture store that he works in, but it extends on and on and on. And then he's got a psychiatrist who he's seeing and doing kind of counseling with, and he tells her about the Backrooms. And shortly after he ends up not showing up to an appointment, she goes looking for him. And that's kind of the general synopsis of the movie. And I'm a big fan. I was very curious, how do you take something like Liminal Spaces, and in particular the Backrooms web series, which is so light on narrative and certainly doesn't feature any like characters in the traditional sense in them, how do you take that and then make a satisfying motion picture out of it? And I think they did a really good job of splitting the difference between what we've kind of come to expect out of A24 films while still capturing that kind of eeriness and emptiness of what liminal spaces are, which are very entrenched in a world during the pandemic where shopping malls really were empty. And so I don't think it's any big surprise why kids are making horror movies, but that's what Backrooms is about.
So have you seen the original shorts that that this was based on?
Yeah, I have.
So talk to me a little bit about how it makes this transition.
It's interesting because the web series itself is found footage vignettes, but the Backrooms themselves predate the short films that he made. So he kind of adds his own lore, omits certain things that were kind of known from other creators that played within this space. But it really is just focused on atmosphere and puts you in the driver's seat, as opposed to in a traditional narrative, you've got a point of view character, a protagonist, if you will, where if the web series was super story heavy, it wouldn't have had the same emotional impact as it did. And if you go to a movie that lacks that kind of cohesive thread throughout it, that's not a fulfilling experience at the movies. So by casting these two just incredibly heavy hitter actors, getting the cinematographer that's worked with Oz Perkins on Keeper and other movies, they were able to create an atmosphere that feels very true to the web series while also feeling very cinematic. And I think they did it super well. Also, they built like 90,000 square feet of actual back rooms, where from the web series, it was all Blender created. So it's a fantastic adaptation. I don't know how they pulled it off.
So it does have that more narrative through point that you'd be looking for in like a feature film, rather than just, you know, here's like 20 seconds of creepy stuff in a web video.
So, yeah, or like you mentioned Skinamarink earlier, where as far as a point of view character, you're kind of watching this very mundane experience through the eyes of a camera who actually ends up being this kid. It's very, very experimental and either is going to work for you or not. But I think that mainstream audiences will be able to go in and see Backrooms. And while it has proven to be much more divisive than an obsession, in particular among fans, I think that it's conventional enough that it's not going to just put you completely off.
Now, this is a horror movie. Is it a hard R horror movie, or, you know, 'cause like I saw like some discussion online about, and I'm not trying to bring this back around to Star Wars, I swear, but that there was some feeling that like Backrooms was going to do decently, but it wasn't going to really cut into Mandalorian and Grogu, but now the feeling is a lot of 13-year-olds just went to see Backrooms because they knew it from YouTube. Is this like a PG-13 or is it an R?
I mean, if it's, I would say the R mostly comes from language. There is some blood in it, but it's not a nasty movie in the way that you would think. Maybe like it's more bloody than Blair Witch Project or Paranormal Activity, but it's nowhere near as bloody as like Saw, or, you know what I mean?
Okay. So, but like, would a 13-year-old be able to buy a ticket and go see this on his own, or is it an actual R-rated film?
I mean, Yeah, it's an actual R-rated film. And to your point about a 13-year-old, the director never lived in a world where YouTube didn't exist. He was born into YouTube.
That's crazy.
And he's 20. So like the idea that it's super young people is a little bit of a misnomer, because there are people that are 25 now that never witnessed 9/11. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's crazy to think about. You know, my daughter was born in 2000. So she's too young to remember it, but she, you know, precedes it.
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane to think about. Yeah, we live in a world where there's adults that never lived without not just the internet, but without social media.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy. And I think that kind of opens up to the broader discussion real quick on obsession, because I know we've talked about it. It's about a guy named Bear who's early 20s. Life isn't really going anywhere. He's recently kind of undergone some tragedies, and has a really strong crush on this girl named Nikki. And just kind of in an act of desperation one night, he cracks open this thing, like it's called a one-wish willow. And it grants him a wish, but in the tradition of any great monkey paw story, the wish isn't exactly the way that he wanted it, which leads to Nikki being obsessed with him in a way that is dangerous and terrifying. And it's actually really funny and has more dark humor in it than I expected. And I think that's why it has turned out to be a crowd favorite in the way that it does, because it's both extremely dark and unsettling and also pretty funny.
I understand that the actress that plays Nikki is quite a find, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing I don't like about this, Julio, is, and it's just typical hyperbole, we live in an era where things are the best or the worst, but by saying that Indy Navarrete deserves an Academy Award for her performance in Obsession, it kind of diminishes the fact that Toni Collette really did deserve an award for Hereditary, but that's a whole separate conversation.
Yeah, you don't really want to get me started on that topic. because I 150% agree with that. I mean, it's, but you know, on the flip side of that, you know, and it's always hard for any movie this early in the year, especially a summer film, to have that kind of longevity to where it gets the recognition by the time the Oscars roll around at the end of the year, mm-hmm. beginning of the next year. But that being said, we're just coming off of Amy Madigan winning for Weapons.
That's a really good point.
And we're coming off of, you know, Michael B. Jordan winning for Sinners. And Sinners came out even earlier in the year than this.
And I shouldn't say that what Indy Navarrete gives is not a incredible and very demanding performance. I just think it oscillates between two or three gears through the whole thing. And that to me, it seems a little limited. It's like, it's really good at being over the top in what it is. But if you told me Amy Madigan was going to win for Weapons, I wouldn't have taken that bet.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was something that kind of gained steam towards the end of the year. By the end of the year, like, yeah. I was like, okay, yeah, she's got a good chance at this. But, like, when the film came out, no. And, I mean, that wasn't...
And if you told me it's an Oscar performance after we saw Weapons, I would have been like, I don't know, man. I don't think it is. And I would have been wrong.
Well, didn't... correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Weapons also get a screenplay nod?
I don't know if it won it, but it definitely
didn't win, because the screenplay winners were one by after another in Sinners. But again, Sinners is a horror film too, and it is an original creation, and it is something didn't come from YouTube, which is the main, you know, kind of thesis of our discussion today. But it absolutely did come from the singular mind of one writer director. Who took this passion project to a studio, and they gave him the money and they got it. It got made and it got rave reviews and it did huge box office. So that's kind of that where I want to lead this discussion when we come back from the break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. My co-host, Jeremy Branch, is on the line. I love that song, and there is no more appropriate song for what we're talking about today than Internet Killed the Video Star by the Limousines. Because that is exactly what we're talking about. You know, we've got these two new movies that have come out in the last few weeks, Backrooms and Obsession, that are the part, I would say, like the crest of the first wave of YouTubers breaking out into mainstream motion pictures in terms of as auteurs, not just as like, you know, a personality or something like that, but somebody who's come up with this creative vision that they've now taken from the little screen in your pocket to the big screen in the theater.
So while we're on this part of this conversation, I want to put in my caveat and get you to weigh in on it.
Okay.
Chris Stuckman was a movie reviewer turned filmmaker, and he made Shelby Oaks. Markiplier, like you mentioned before, was a video game reactor. He did streams where he would play horror games and react to that, and he took his 57 million subscribers and parlayed that into a feature film, which his story is amazing. He didn't go through the studio system at all. Mm-hmm. So like props to him for that. But when I look at Chris Stuckman and I look at Markiplier, I say, those guys are YouTubers. But when I look at Curry Barker, or I look at Pixels, King Pixels, I don't look at them as YouTubers. I look at them as filmmakers who happen to have this powerful medium in front of them. But in the same way that we looked at Tarantino and Kevin Smith and all of these other filmmakers, we don't call Fede Alvarez a YouTuber, even though Fede Alvarez's first short films were uploaded to YouTube. So I wonder how they feel about being called YouTubers versus just being called filmmakers.
That's an interesting question. And you know, during the break, we were kind of talking about when I realized that the Kane Parsons, is that the guy's name?
Yes.
Yeah, that he not only did the, you know, not only wrote and directed for Backrooms, but he did the score too. Like, where my mind instantly went to is Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Who is a filmmaker. Yeah. Who started, you know, much like these guys did, self-taught, no money, rustled up, you know, a few grand and shot this this epic, like the small scale epic, I guess I should say, in El Mariachi in Mexico. Uh-huh. With the crew that he could find, and he wrote it and he directed it and he did the score, and you know, it got this out there, got it released to film festivals, made a little bit of money, and was seen as this this auteur creator, and you know, continues to work to this day in that same mode. He built his own studio in Austin where he lives, and you know, works out of there, still does all his own his own score work, and you know, has made himself this little cottage industry in the Hollywood echelon. And yeah. I guess that's, yeah, that's like, if you think about it, filmmakers like the 90s indie wave, with which Rodriguez was a leader of, and Tarantino was a leader of, and Kevin Smith was a leader of, and
countless others, Wes Anderson, Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, Wes Anderson, Steven Soderbergh, Richard Linklater, you know, all of these like maverick filmmakers that were coming up out of nowhere and making these hugely influential and popular films. Like, is YouTube the story here, or is YouTube just the medium that has gotten these people enough recognition to get into theaters? And is this,
it's
really
like, what
the next
choice did they have? You know, like if Kevin Smith had a place that he could upload it and potentially get an audience, he would have done the same thing. So that's kind of why I wanted to just propose that question, because I feel independent horror is the story, and that YouTube is the distraction from what it really is.
Well, and then the question mark is that the wrong lesson that we can expect Hollywood to take from this? And are they going to just start throwing a ton of money at YouTubers indiscriminately, willy-nilly? Indiscriminately, willy-nilly.
And of course they are.
And I mean, you know, again, if you're going to compare it to the 90s indie thing, you know, you had, for every Pulp Fiction, you had 100 things to do in Denver when you're dead's. You know,
yeah,
which, you know, perfectly fine movie. Well, you know, it's not anything that people find very memorable, but, you know, it was very much a, hey, this is kind of like Quentin Tarantino.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't want to undersell the importance of having a built-in audience. especially in the case of Markiplier, his project was funded by this massive following that he had gained over the last 15 years, and Backrooms had massive success outside of it. Curry Barker, on the other hand, the director of Obsession, is not like some massive YouTube breakout that kind of transcended in that way. Somebody just, the right person saw that and said, we can work with that guy. So I don't want to say that having a built-in audience that you cultivated on YouTube doesn't have weight or add value to the project. I just don't feel that calling them YouTubers, except for Chris Stuckman and Markiplier, is really, because it's not like they're uploading videos like, hey, what's up, guys? I'm unboxing this Nintendo Switch that I just got. You know what I mean?
I understand where you're coming from. I don't disagree. The other thing I want to get into here a little bit is I've seen some articles, and I have seen some people that I know that are film buffs and are like, well, the lesson here is that people are hungry for original stuff. And, you know, and to an extent, I think that's true. But they're like, oh, well, this is the death of, you know, superhero movies. This is the death of big franchises. This is the death of yada, yada, yada. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think there's room enough for everything. And the illustration that I saw of this, and bear with me here. There was a story that broke at the yesterday, I think it was Monday rather, excuse me, that there is going to be a remake of Escape from New York.
Uh-huh.
Directed by Zack Snyder.
Uh-huh.
And immediately I saw, well, this is exactly the lesson that they're learning from this week, being sarcastic, that should not be the lesson that we're learning from this week, and that they should instead put that money into finding the next, the next Kane Parsons. Mm-hmm. And I can see both arguments. Like, I do not in any way want a Zack Snyder directed remake of Escape from New York. Although, in fairness, Zack Snyder's best film is a remake. So, you know, who knows? But I think there's still a market for both of them. And when you think about it, $82 million that we said Backrooms made this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So figure the average movie ticket costs $20 right now. It means, assuming that every ticket was sold to somebody, one person that was seeing the film for the first time, which may not be the case. Some people may have seen it multiple times over the weekend, but let's just assume that for fairness. That's 4.1 million people going to see it, which is a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Until you think about the fact that there are more than 200 million people in this country. That does not mean that the vast majority of this country is looking for indie horror from people that grew up from YouTube.
And to your point, and I think this kind of further proves it, Mandalorian and Grogu, a lot more people went and saw it. I think for the industry to continue to thrive, we do need to look at younger audiences instead of looking at them as, oh, they have TikTok brain, they have brain rot, they don't even know how to sit still for 2 hours, and say, if we give them stuff that they're interested in, they'll show up.
Make good movies.
Yeah. We both agree on that 100%.
Yeah, it doesn't.
But more people going to see Star Wars doesn't equal better profit, but it does show there's still an audience for it. Where yeah. What you said, I totally agree with. Just we have to stop gatekeeping and saying, like, oh, the future of the industry is dead because people don't have the attention span for it anymore.
Yeah, what doesn't matter is, it doesn't matter the source and it doesn't matter the genre. What matters is make good movies, mm-hmm. and promote them effectively, and people will go see them and they will discover them. And yeah, there are exceptions to that, of course. And then, you know, maybe those films find their audience later on streaming, on the internet, on wherever. You know, we can point to any number of movies that's the case on.
Yeah.
But quality will eventually out versus just, you know, hey, you know, to put it in the South Park terms, member berries,
mm-hmm.
you know, something like, you know, I don't want to tar any particular property with the member berry accusation, but there are certainly movies that have been shoddily made for the member berry of it all. And they get a little hit of dopamine, make a little money, and then they're done and they're forgotten about. But you can make a good movie that comes from that starting point and end up having a great movie. I'll point out a great example, actually. The movie that just got a 4K re-release, Speed Racer. First of all, a film that was made for the member berries to begin with. And then the Wachowskis made this film. Not a lot of people went to see it, but over the past 20 years, people have discovered this is a great film. And like now it's a very well-regarded film, just got a re-release. It took a while, but the quality on that film has outed. So, you know, I think from the artistic standpoint, that's what you're really looking for. Don't just back up a money truck to every YouTuber's house. Although, 100%. You know, I will start a YouTube account if that's what you're going to do. But yeah, just be smart about it. Find the right guys. Find the guys like these guys that clearly have a vision. And that is the route that we need to take. We got to run. We'll be back next week with more. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.